Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is by G. Wayne Miller for the Providence Journal.
We've been really busy. So as you probably know, Pawtucket was the first city that was hit with COVID in Rhode Island. And yes. So we had to figure out really quickly how we were going to adjust our lives, our work lives around this, and how we were going to meet our patients' needs. And so we had two main goals. One was trying to help keep people safe, both our employees and our patients. And the other one was to continue to provide as much primary care as we possibly could, given the circumstances. And I feel pretty good that we managed to do both of those things, to be honest with you. We pretty quickly created a model where we segregated patients who might have symptoms into a different building in a different area, so that people who were more vulnerable, newborns, pregnant women, elderly who might be otherwise immunocompromised, could feel safer coming in if they needed to. We also provided...
So that was the separate facility where they felt safe coming in?
Right.
Not this one?
Right.
I mean, not
we
this
made
building.
This building the building for people who had potential symptoms.
Okay.
And when we first started this, we didn't even have testing. We didn't have testing for a couple weeks. And so basically anyone with any kind of a sniffle, fever, any kind of symptoms, we tried to manage by telephone at the time. But if we were worried about them, we would bring them in here if we thought we could potentially avoid sending them to the hospital. And then in the other two buildings, we continued doing primary care, but especially for those patients who might be the most vulnerable. We actively outreached to two main groups, especially during the summertime. One is children for their vaccines to keep them vaccinated and get them ready to go back to school, which we were hoping was going to happen in September, and sort of did. And we were actually able to not only maintain our childhood vaccination rate, but actually improve it by 10% because we were so aggressive outreaching. And then we also did a lot of outreach with patients who have uncontrolled chronic disease. So people whose diabetes is not well controlled, blood pressure is not well controlled. Those are the patients we really targeted over the summer to try to increase the chances that were they to get COVID, they would have a better outcome. Because we were assuming that uncontrolled diabetes, other uncontrolled illnesses would increase your risk of death from COVID. So we spent a lot of
which
time...
Which was true.
Which is true, right? But yeah. At the time, we were sort of like making our best guess,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And similarly, at the beginning, they said, well, pregnant women don't seem to be at higher risk. But, you know, you have that feeling in your heart that I've been doing this long enough that pregnant women are almost always at higher risk for these sorts of infections. If you look at influenza, for instance. And so we decided to segregate them out. Children and pregnant women, anybody we thought could be vulnerable, we would put aside. We did a lot of care via telemedicine, mostly via telephone, but some video visits. We were able to keep all of our lines of service open, including dental, including optometry and behavioral health, by triaging everybody by phone first and trying to be really careful and thoughtful about who we brought in. But that meant that if you're one of our patients and you had a toothache, even if it was April, you could still see a dentist, even if it was virtually to start. Our behavioral health department really flourished in this model because patients, first of all, needed a lot of behavioral health services at the start of this, and still. But secondly, really appreciated the ability to connect with their therapists by telephone. Just the access was much better, and so, you know, our rates I'm trying to think what the word is. Sorry. The behavioral, the number of patients being seen by behavioral health actually increased.
Census?
Yes, sort of, census. Sort of census. We were able to, let me think what else I wanted to say, something about that with optometry. Similarly, you know, if you had an eye issue, Dr. Paris remained available to see patients, usually initially by phone, sometimes a video visit, and sometimes she would meet them here. Like many places, our biggest barrier initially was PPE. We were really trying to keep people safe while continuing to work here, and trying to keep the patients safe required PPE, and really trying to make sure we had enough and strategize about how we could, in the absence of lots of N95s, try to keep people safe with distancing and sort of spreading things out. Another thing that we tried to be really proactive about is whether we were seeing these patients by telephone or in person, being really mindful of any services they might need and not be able to get for the next year. So for instance, if a patient was in for a blood pressure check, noticing that this person might be due for a pap smear, might be due for a vaccine, might be due for a colonoscopy test or a colon cancer screening, trying to get all of that done in one visit. Because we didn't know when we would see these patients again. We didn't really know what the course would be, but my guess at the time was it would be a year before anything sort of started to resemble normal. And in doing so, we were actually able to keep steady all of our cancer screening rates, so cervical, colon, and breast cancer screening rates stayed the same, and have even started to improve, which is kind of great. It's pretty awesome, actually.
So obviously there were a lot of obstacles to providing quality care, needless to say. What about staff? What did they do to make things work? Did they above and beyond the call of duty? Or just in general?
Yeah, no, I think I can't say enough about how amazed I am by our staff, even every day now. They have been incredibly brave, following protocols, researching stuff, you know, the other physicians, because there's just a fire hose of information coming every day. So making sure we met on a weekly basis to sort of make sure we were all on top of things. Our frontline staff has been incredible, absolutely incredible. Swabbing people for COVID in the middle of a deadly pandemic that we weren't even 100% sure how it was transmitted, we had no treatment for, and they continued to do it, and they worked really hard because they are really committed to this patient population. And in order to help them do their jobs, that's where the PPE comes in, to make sure that they could feel safe. So working really hard to make sure that we created space, masking, reminders about how to do, how to keep one another safe, lots of education, lots of checking in to make sure people weren't finding problems. When they did find problems, being responsive to it. Pretty early on, we discovered that people with stomach symptoms, GI symptoms, were testing positive for COVID without respiratory symptoms. So that was one of those moments where nobody had really talked about that yet, but they were starting to see that here. So we changed our screening protocol for that, because now it wasn't just people with cold symptoms and a fever, but it was cold symptoms, a fever, and stomach upset. And I think that's pretty great. It's reflective of a pretty great process of constantly checking in and really working as a team.
Did any staff members get COVID?
They did. Definitely we had staff members get COVID. It was probably a handful of people got COVID, and I think Ray will tell you it was much safer to work here than it was to go to the supermarket. The vast majority of people who work here and got COVID had a positive family member at home already.
So the transmission probably was not
here. Right. And if you're wearing your mask all day here, you're not wearing a mask at home, right? So most of us aren't wearing a mask at home.
What about the mental health aspect of staff? I mean, how are they doing? How do they manage that? Because I've written a lot about that. You know, health frontline people
are exhausted.
Yeah, that's one word, yeah.
Right.
Exhausted, fatigued.
Burnt out.
Some, you know, I've written about people who didn't want to go home because
they were afraid.
Yeah, afraid of bringing it.
So I hadn't heard about anybody that was afraid to go home.
Yeah.
There were naturally people who were afraid to work and who felt reluctant to potentially work in the respiratory clinic. One thing we did from the very start was offer to allow staff to let us know if they had some sort of a predisposing condition that might make them higher risk. And we sort of blinded the information, so I wouldn't know that Jane has lupus, but I would know that this person has lupus. And we just sort of tried to take all of those people and take them out of the respiratory clinic. And that included pregnant patients, which I think really helped people feel, A, like being transparent and that they could trust us and that we really cared. I think the main thing we did to try to help them, obviously, you know, different organizations gave lunches and, you know, we had patients dropping off N95s. It was incredible. But we just tried to check in on a really frequent basis. For a while in this building, we checked in every single morning. How is everybody doing? What are you worried about? Yes, this is really difficult. Let's take a moment and think about that.
How did you do that? Meet in-person meetings or?
They were meeting in person and then we did some Zoom. Okay. So it was sort of a mix of people. And I think that was really important because I think it's very easy when you're down here to feel like nobody's paying attention. Do they even know what we're going through? Do they know how this feels?
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.